Folks, it's springtime, and this week's special at drhoffman.com is Core Restore, a one-stop shop for your detoxification needs. That's Core Restore. Look for it at drhoffman.com and come browse our full selection of great products at drhoffman.com. Click on the store. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today's subject is integrative obstetrics and gynecology, women's health. And we're going to talk to one of the outstanding leaders in the field of integrative holistic medicine, treating both men and women and teens. But he is a board-certified OBGYN. He no longer delivers babies or does surgery, but he is a founding diplomat and director emeritus of the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine. He's a member of the American Holistic Medical Association, and he was a founding physician and director of the women's program at Beth Israel's Continuum Center for Health and Healing in New York City. That's a pioneering program at a hospital incorporating natural healing and integrative medicine. And he specializes in bioidentical hormones, and he is the author of a book entitled Healing Fibroids, A Doctor's Guide to a Natural Cure. So welcome to Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Warshawski.
Thanks very much.
We've been colleagues for a long time, so I'm going to refer to you as Alan. We've known each other over many years. Tell us a little bit about how you personally got involved in the field of integrative women's care.
Well, it really happened, right after my residency, where I found myself working with many women who are newly diagnosed with PMS or premenstrual syndrome. When I started in practice in the late 70s, it was really no more than a joke in the media. It was not taken very seriously.
It's like hocus pocus
and
I found voodoo.
That working with them and just talking and listening to symptoms and using just a few vitamins, many of them improved. That was also about the time when hormone replacement therapy became a big thing, using the horse estrogen Premarin. I remember actually the grand rounds when, as a resident, they introduced Provera, the synthetic progestin, to balance out the Premarin to prevent uterine cancer. And that was the prevailing hormone therapy in those days. I didn't find that women did very well with that, so I started looking for other ways of dealing with some of these symptoms of menopause, and I came across the work of Dr. John Lee, who was doing a lot of work with natural progesterone, not using a synthetic progestin, but instead the same hormone that women had in their bodies all their lives. And then from there, got involved with the American Holistic Medical Association and worked with people like Christian Northrup and others, and really started developing a more kind of holistic or integrative approach to women's health care.
Well, talk to us. That's actually a good point you mentioned earlier. We're talking about the synthetic hormones, or the horse-derived hormones. A lot of people don't know that Premarin is short for pregnant mare's urine. That's where they get that particular form of conjugated estrogen, and then they chemically alter it to be a patentable substance. Bioidentical hormones, including natural progesterone, are a big part of your practice. So how do they differ from the conventionally prescribed hormones?
Well, as you said, the conventionally prescribed hormones until very recently really consisted of Premarin, which was very strong for most women. Commercial hormones also now include a bioidentical hormone, the strong estrogen estradiol. So that's, also available now as a bioidentical, but very difficult to manipulate in an individual way. The bioidentical hormones that are compounded, at least when I do them, are compounded in a way that allows the woman to find her own specific individualized dose. So whether we use them through the skin transdermally or underneath the tongue through the blood vessels in the mouth. What we're doing is we're giving the woman symptoms and indicators to follow, and then allowing her to increase or decrease her hormones as she needs to. The bioidentical hormones, as I said, related to the progesterone, also is true for the estrogens, is that they're the same hormones that the woman has had her ovary making for her all her life. So there are pathways already set up for detoxification and for excretion, and you know, we know how to keep these hormones in balance because we know how to manipulate many of these pathways. With the synthetics, we don't. We don't often know what the synthetic breakdown products are going to be, what their effects are going to be, and what's the best way of getting rid of them. So from a safety perspective, the bioidentical hormones have a much longer track record of not only being safer, but being able to be manipulated in a more intelligent manner.
You talked earlier about Dr. Lee and natural progesterone. What are some of the advantages to natural progesterone, and what can it be used for? It's also, it happens to be available over-the-counter as well as via prescription.
Well, the over-the-counter is a 3% progesterone cream. This is what Dr. Lee worked with most of his life. And we use this transdermally, obviously, because we want this absorbed right into the blood supply. In the old days when Dr. Lee had started working with natural progesterone, they were rubbing it into fatty areas, thinking it would get stored there. But what they found was happening was that large amounts could be excreted into the bloodstream in a short period of time. If a woman was losing weight or exercising excessively, there could be a large amount in the bloodstream, and that led to depression. So we've learned to use this cream through areas of thin skin. The 3% cream is equivalent. Two doses of the 3% cream in the second half of a woman's cycle is basically equivalent to what a healthy ovary would make. So in a menstruating female, someone in the reproductive years, they may need a natural progesterone boost in the luteal phase, the second half of the menstrual cycle, for premenstrual symptoms that are related to estrogen dominance. Older women wanting to conceive may also have low progesterone levels that would make it difficult to carry a fetus beyond an embryo, actually, beyond the first 6 weeks of the pregnancy. By 12 weeks of pregnancy, the placenta is producing enormous amounts of natural progesterone. So generally, in women who are trying to conceive, who are older, or who have ineffective amounts of progesterone produced in that luteal phase, would use a 3% cream.
You know, one of the questions that I ask, you know, per your discussion about the placenta and how it cranks out progesterone, is if a woman has had kids and maybe she's having some problems, at or near menopause, or perhaps later in her menstrual history, she may still be menstruating but having a lot of symptoms. I ask, how did you feel when you were pregnant? And some women said, I felt awful the whole time. It was terrible. But many women say, I really felt good. I was relaxed. I felt content. My bodily aches and pains subsided. And that clearly is a sign that their bodies respond well to progesterone, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there are theories, I don't think it's been well worked out, but that low progesterone levels not only could interfere with nursing, but could also increase the tendency of postpartum depression and postpartum mood issues. So it may be low progesterone that had been peaking in pregnancy now is very low, mm-hmm. that bring on some of these symptoms that are somewhat similar to the mood issues in premenstrual syndrome as mm-hmm. well.
Like a withdrawal, you know, when the levels are high, you feel good, but then when it's rapidly withdrawn, the body goes into a tailspin.
Correct.
So you talked about estrogen dominance. Now, this is not going to be the campaign slogan for Hillary Clinton when she runs in 2016, is it? There's something medical about this, correct?
That's very good, though. Yeah, no, this is very medical, and this not only affects women, this affects men as well, and probably children and people in pre-puberty years as well. We see more and more young girls having earlier periods and developing breasts at an early age. We see young boys now. We have many young boys with gynecomastia. And these are indicators of early onset of estrogen dominance.
Mm-hmm.
These issues are probably coming from these xeno or foreign estrogens in our environment, and we're discovering more and more every day these chemicals in our environment are endocrine disruptors, and most of them increase the effect of estrogens in these in the bodies of these young prepubertal kids.
I think they just came out with the fact that phthalates, which are present in plastics, they're present in PVC pipes that we put our water supply through, that they can interfere with testosterone function and that they may be endocrine disruptors with the xenoestrogen effect.
Right, and the parabens as well that are found in so many personal care products.
Right.
And the BPA that we have in most of our canned goods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm happy to see that there are some of the better companies now. If you shop at places like Whole Foods, I mean, there can't say BPA free. So the word is getting out that we have many chemical disruptors and endocrine disruptors in the environment, and these are creating a state of endocrine estrogen dominance in our young kids. And then this continues throughout life. Women who have significant premenstrual symptoms are often estrogen dominant. The condition of polycystic ovarian syndrome, which was a relative rarity when I was in residency, is we see it now all the time. This is the major endocrine imbalance in women. It's the major reason for infertility in women these days, and it's a syndrome that includes estrogen dominance because there's a failure of ovulation. Failure of ovulation can come along with any kind of stressor. We know that in times of famine and times of stress or war or whatever, there's a decreased fertility rate. That's not just that the guys are not around.
Mm-hmm.
In times of stress, there's a reduction in ovulation, and that's the only time that women produce progesterone in any quantity is when they ovulate. So any syndrome of lack of ovulation will increase estrogen dominance, and then, of course, all the conditions that come along with that, probably the most fearful being the cancers, breast cancer associated with estrogen dominance. And certainly in men, there's still the question of estrogen dominance, not only in their body types, the gynecomastia, big-bellied kind of guy, but also the potential for prostate cancer. So I don't think the final word is in yet on the hormone that's most responsible for prostate cancer.
Yeah, actually, they've said that they're now casting some doubt on the traditional belief that it's just testosterone per se, and that it may be estrogen, which is actually a byproduct of aromatization of testosterone, but also can come from the environment. That may be the cause of this vast uptick in prostate cancer among men.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So this theme of estrogen dominance kind of pervades our entire society from young children up to adulthood and beyond.
So
many of problems related to even menopause are related to estrogen dominance. I think work was done by Geraldine Pryor in Canada, looking at the area under the curve in women in perimenopause, looking at estrogen.
That's on a graph. That's not the women's curves, although these women tend to be a little more curvaceous, shall we say.
This was on a graph with the X and Y axes, and she showed that the total estrogen produced during perimenopause was actually higher than in the years preceding the transition.
Yeah, that's an important theme because I think a lot of women think that, over the years their estrogen gradually decreases, or that you hit menopause and all of a sudden it's like turning off a light switch. Actually, I say to some of the women patients that I see is that your estrogen production is a little bit like the 1812 overture. It kind of goes out with a bang, and you may have a big surge of estrogen with lots of PMS-y symptoms and mood stuff and breast tenderness and enlargement and a lot of bloating, water retention, right prior to the cessation of your periods.
That's true, and most hysterectomies for fibroid tumors of the uterus are done in the transitional years. They've theorized and calculated that most breast tumors, the beginnings of breast tumors, start again in those transitional years.
So how do you, in your practice, diagnose a woman with estrogen dominance? What clues you into the fact that you should be undertaking some kind of therapeutic strategy to fix that?
Well, you know, women come in and you could often just by looking at them have an idea of where they're going to be at in terms of their estrogens. You know, women who, are craving carbohydrates and who are overweight, have a history of gallbladder problems or have had their gallbladder removed, have any kind of irregular bleeding when they come in during those years. I mean, these are the initial giveaways. And then, you know, when you look at a family history and there are several indicators of, you know, the mother has had hysterectomy for one reason or another and there's breast cancer, ovarian, prostate cancer, colon cancer, you know that there are going to be hormonal issues. And then, of course, you know, we measure hormone levels, pretty extensively, and not only to look at what the estrogen levels in women or testosterone levels in men would be, but you mentioned the aromatase enzyme. These hormones don't work by themselves. They're not disconnected. I mean, it's the entire body we know is connected, the mind, body, spiritual connections. So hormones are intimately connected. So if you're looking at estrogens, you have to look at, you know, all the estrogens, the estrogen breakdown products, the hydroxyestrogens, and the methyl estrogens. So these are all, you know, issues that would help you to figure out how the hormone imbalance is being created. What enzymes do you need to act upon to get hormones back into balance? So, and also including hormones that are coming from the adrenal and the thyroid, and certainly insulin coming from the pancreas. These hormones all interact, and to get a good idea of how to rebalance hormones, you need to look at all of them. But initially, you know, it's the significantly overweight woman who comes in fatigued, foggy-headed, history of gallbladder disease. These are the people that you have to really focus in on and evaluate clearly and closely.
And, of course, fibroids are part of that picture, right? Because with the excess hormone production, it tends to stimulate the growth of these hormone-dependent myomas, which are benign tumors, but they can, in some instances, become dangerous cancers.
Yeah, we've just seen that. There have been several articles in the papers. There was one a couple of weeks ago in the Times.
Morselization, I think, is the
Morselization.
Tell us about that. That's a real. That's an example of, high tech medicine gone awry, right?
Well, it's something that you always have to be concerned about when you start, increasing the technological aspects of what you're doing, because it does sometimes get away from you. And it's like that in all of medicine. You know, you think you know a little bit about something, there's so much more that you're missing. I always think about, diagnosis in medicine is like the blind men and the elephant. You're feeling one part of it, you're missing another part of it. But morselization is a process that developed out of laparoscopic surgery or mini laparotomy. It actually began with the gynecologist because we started doing laparoscopic or mini laparotomies for tubal ligations. And we were doing that back in the 70s. Then the surgeons, the general surgeons, got a hold of it and started doing appendectomies the same way, still taking out small, pieces, through these, one or two-inch incisions.
Like a tiny porthole. And this is really thought to be an advance over this radical hysterectomy in the past, where they would take everything out, or you have a big belly incision, big scar, and a major surgery with blood loss. This is a form of less invasive ways of dealing with fibroids.
Well, certainly initially, it was the recuperation time for a mini laparotomy compared to a major surgery was much less. Blood loss was less. Other aspects of the surgery seemed to be, less risky, but there were significant time increases. The surgery is done, you know, by manipulating, you know, different kinds of machines. Now doing robotics makes it even more time, you know, time effective. But the problem with morselization is, well, it was a way of solving the issue of taking out a very large fibroid, which can grow to the size of a grapefruit or larger. How do you bring a large mass like that through a tiny incision? So new machinery, new tools were created to actually break up or chew up this fibroid inside the abdominal cavity and then take it out bit by bit. Unfortunately, what has happened with this is that some pieces of the tumor that's being morselated actually starts growing on other aspects of the abdominal cavity. So benign fibroids could start growing on the inside abdominal wall or on the intestines or whatever, but that's not the big problem. The big problem is that you can very easily miss the rare malignant fibroid, the leiomyosarcoma. And when this one gets morselated, not only does it just kind of, you know, grow on the surface it falls on like a muscle or a barnacle, it spreads and grows and destroys everything in sight. And the few cases of morselated sarcomas have been really devastating, yeah, with been dying in 6 to 12 months.
Right. I mean, it's almost like putting a like a electronic blender inside and slicing and dicing. And, yeah, you can get some of the bad stuff out, but you can also spread potentially a cancer. So I think this therapy is going to be questioned. So what about natural therapies for fibroids? I think that this is a good point for us to pause in our discussion because you are the author of Healing Fibroids. Our guest is Dr. Alan Warshawski, and this is part one of our discussion with Dr. Warshawski. When we return, we'll talk about natural approaches to the very, very prevalent problem of fibroids. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.